the first place. It appeared in the end he was only getting back at himself. The other woman gave birth to a son. The boy was named Kenny. He was born a few months after Sonia's baby was born. Kenny would grow up as an outside son, knowing his father George from afar and valuing him more than perhaps anyone else on earth, because he was in some ways more like his father than anyone else and loved what little he knew of him. Los Angeles, 1967. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. Rufus Clement and his son-in-law Robert Foster were at opposite ends of the Great Migration. They represented the two roads that stood before the majority of black people at the start of the century. One man had stayed in the South. One had left it behind. Both had worked long and hard and had all the material comforts most any American could dream of. Yet both men wanted to prove to the other and to everyone else that his was the wiser choice, his life the more meaningful one. President Clement was the tight-buttoned scion of the Southern black bourgeoisie. Robert was a brilliant but tortured free spirit who had run from the very strictures Clement stood for. Clement was a distinguished accommodationist in the Jim Crow South, a beneficiary of it, in fact. He was not unlike the colored university president in Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, whose allegiance was, above all, to the institution he ran, which had become an extension of himself. He was a pragmatist who had learned the fine art of extracting whatever he needed from guilt-ridden Northerners or poorly credentialed but powerful segregationists who wouldn't want him living next to them, but might grant him a concession or donate to his cause, the colored graduate school, Atlanta University. He was so vigilant as to his place in the colored hierarchy that he kept a card file near his desk, Time magazine reported, on every black person in the United States that he considered worthy of a high position in government and education, in case he got a query from Washington. Without trying, Rufus Clement had become an unwitting rival of Robert, not only for the affections of Robert's wife and children, but in both men's unspoken effort to prove that where each man had ended up was the better place for colored people. Robert had made out well as a noted surgeon in Los Angeles, but it did not rate with his father-in-law Rufus Clement, who had staked his claim in the South and prospered. President Clement had avoided the messy confrontations of the civil rights era, saying at one point that he'd been disturbed, as any right-thinking Southerner might be, by the sit-ins, but recognized that this is the way in which they have tried to dramatize the way in which the American Negro has to live in his own country. He reassured white Southerners that we don't want to sit beside you. We just want to sit when we eat, like other people sit. We don't want to intermarry with your people. We simply want to get a drink of water where there is a drinking fountain available. His patient and deferential ambitions paid off in 1953, when against the longest of odds, he was elected to the Atlanta Board of Education, a first for a colored person there, while Robert, by contrast, was doing physicals and collecting urine samples for Golden State Insurance in what then seemed an unpromising start in California. The Clements hovered over Robert and pulled at his wife and daughters from afar. And as they did, Robert retreated further into the world of his patients, his bookies, and the B-list musicians he liked to hang around with. He was drinking more and coming in late. He had fallen hard for Vegas and now had discovered horse racing. He joined the club room at Santa Anita, since now he could well afford it, and liked to catch the trifectas at Hollywood Park Racetrack down in Inglewood. He would go to Vegas whenever the spirit hit him and could play long and well. "I don't need to eat and rarely need to go to the bathroom," Robert would say. "I can go 36 hours. He liked the Sands Hotel and the Las Vegas Hilton. He went so often and bet so much that the hotels started comping him rooms and meals. Some trips he brought back tens of thousands of dollars. Some trips he lost that much. But he was hooked. While he was out betting heavy and looking for something that did not exist and that nobody could give him, Alice set about establishing herself as a proper surgeon's wife. She joined the links and the auxiliary of doctors' wives and hosted teas and bridge parties for the same kind of social set she had grown accustomed to back in Atlanta. The girls took piano and voice lessons and came out at their cotillions in white princess gowns. They were living parallel lives, and Alice and the girls tried not to notice that Robert, whose long hours helped finance their ball gowns and socials, was trying to fill some hole that could not be filled and was hardly ever around. At one point, Alice had had enough. She packed up the girls and moved back to Atlanta with the Clements, who surely had not approved of how their daughter and granddaughters were faring with Robert. Somehow, Alice and Robert made up, and she came back to Los Angeles. But nothing really had changed. They had both come into their own and seemed less suited in some ways than before. Perhaps they had always been ill-suited for each other, but were just beginning to realize it, now that they had a life and a family and reputations to protect. They reached a kind of understanding and came together on the shining occasions when their mutual love of hosting and socializing happened to intersect at the grand parties they threw and the costumes they wore. It was a ritual, and they had an understanding. Robert dressed Alice. Robert bought the clothes. Robert chose the clothes. Dressing Alice was his personal project. He studied her as a surveyor would study an isthmus, knew her assets and liabilities as far as tailoring went, and accompanied her not so much as an advocate for her tastes, but as a guardian of his own reputation. When Alice started moving up in the links and had more cotillions to go to, he was happy for her and wanted her to look good. But it was a defensive kind of happiness. He wanted Alice to outdress the other women. "I didn't want those women to say my wife had anything less than the best," Robert said. In the early days, he would prep her before a big formal. "You got to go out there first, baby," he would tell her. "You represent me." Every entrance was a production. They would approach the doorway of a ballroom. Robert would adjust himself and pause to let his wife go before him. "I'd walk 2 paces to the right and the rear and just watch her make that entrance," he said. And she could walk. Before every big occasion, the ritual was the same. The two heading to the store's back room, the sales clerk bringing in dresses that Robert knew were all wrong for Alice, and Robert saying, "Pick what you like." Alice would try on a dress. Robert inspected her and directed her movements. "Walk," he told her, and she would begin. "Come to me," she moved toward him. "Sit." She would find an ottoman and position herself. "Stand," she lifted herself up. "Turn," and she would do so. "If the dress didn't talk to me, it wasn't her dress," he said. "The salespeople go crazy. Who is this man? Who is he?" Over time, he began to sort the big moments of his life by whatever Alice was wearing. It seemed as if he remembered the gown if he remembered nothing else. Those gowns got people talking, and it was exactly what he wanted to hear. "Foster, you dress your women well." "I couldn't be betting $100 on a horse and skimping on my wife," he told me many years later. "I know I'm bragging, and I'm enjoying it." Sometimes the Clements would come out to visit them in Los Angeles, and Robert would put on his most charming performance to prove how well he had made out in the promised land. He invited the colored men of importance in the city to meet with his father-in-law and alerted the Los Angeles Sentinel so that the visit could be captured for posterity, as the Clements would have expected. The two men would never be close, but Robert knew how to put on a show when he had to. By 1966, President Clement had risen to such a level of esteem at Atlanta University that a building was named in his honor, Clement Hall, an August red brick classroom building on the campus promenade, had its formal dedication on October 16, 1966. Alice and Robert's youngest daughter, Joy, in bangs and a white headband, cut the ribbon with her grandfather right behind her. Alice stood watching in a pillbox hat and tailored dark suit and corsage. Bunny was there in a tweed, peacoat and gloves, with her Jackie Kennedy in the White House bob and beautifully chiseled 60s cover girl face in a show of support for her grandfather. Robert did not attend. The man who had managed to oust W.E.B. Du Bois from Atlanta University by lobbying the university's board of trustees all those years ago was in New York in early November 1967 for the regular meeting of that same board of trustees. On the afternoon of Tuesday, November 7th, during a break in the board's proceedings, Clement collapsed in his suite at the Roosevelt Hotel. He died of an apparent heart attack. He was 67 years old. He and his wife Pearl had planned to embark on a round-the-world tour after the board meeting. Instead, plans for interment were made. Pearl would have to move out of the president's mansion at Atlanta University, which had been her home and decorated to her liking for most of her adult life. She would have to move in with her next of kin, her beloved only daughter Alice in Los Angeles. Robert would have a wing with a bedroom and sitting area built for his mother-in-law, and would try to make the best of it. News reports of Rufus Clement's death appeared in the Atlanta Daily World, the New York Amsterdam News, the Los Angeles Sentinel, and elsewhere. The New York Amsterdam News wrote that, in addition to his widow, he is survived by a daughter, Mrs. Robert Foster of Los Angeles. Robert himself went unmentioned. Chicago, February 1968. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. A police wagon pulled up to a West Side hospital over at Division and Kedzie amid a rabble of placard-waving protesters on strike against the hospital, Walther Memorial. The strikers marched at the entrance in the biting cold. They were picketing for higher wages for the orderlies and nurses' aides who did the kinds of things nobody notices until they go undone. Inside the police wagon, bundled up with coats and purses, looking wide-eyed at the people protesting in circles along the sidewalk, were Ida Mae and her co-worker and friend Doris McMurray. For several weeks in February 1968, that was how Ida Mae went to work each day. Ida Mae respected the strikers, knew them by name, had worked right beside them, and got along with most of them. But she wasn't going to stand out there and strike with them. She had been working since she was big enough to get behind a plow. She had had all kinds of back-breaking, mind-numbing, sometimes dangerous, and usually thankless jobs, and had finally come into a position as a hospital aide. She had gotten the job in 1949 after more than a decade of scuffling from domestic to steelworker to press operator. She had finally come into a job she liked and that suited her temperament. She had come a long way from the cotton fields in Mississippi for the chance to work indoors with people rather than outdoors with crops, and to get paid for the job and feel some dignity doing it. She had never stood up to a boss or refused to work or tried to petition for more money, even though she surely could have used it and more than likely deserved it. She had faith that whatever she needed would eventually come to her. The concept of not working a job one had agreed to do was alien to Ida Mae. So when her union local announced it was going on strike at the beginning of 1968, Ida Mae and her friend Doris never considered that they would stop going to work. Decades earlier, colored migrants unaccustomed to unions and not understanding labor politics had been brought in by northern industrialists specifically to break up strikes. White union members resented the migrants and beat them for breaching the picket lines they had unwittingly been brought in to cross. Ida Mae was not schooled in the protocols of union organizing, but she knew she couldn't afford to lose her job and couldn't see how not working was going to help her keep it. She was under more pressure than ever. She and George had just bought their first house, the three flat in South Shore, and had new and different bills coming at them than ever before, from the mortgage to the utilities to property taxes and hazard insurance. "My pastor was just begging me," Ida Mae remembered. "Please don't cross that picket line." Her children were worried for her. "They didn't want me to go. Ida May said, but I wasn't studying them. George was his usual contained self. If he was scared for her, he didn't let on. The idea of not going to work was as foreign to him as it was to Ida May. I don't reckon he ever knowed no different, Ida May said. She made no apology for doing what she felt was living up to her responsibilities. Even the union boss teased her and said he knew why Ida May couldn't strike. She can't stay off, he said. She got to pay for that 3-flat building. She got to pay that house note. You right, Ida May said. When Ida May and Doris told management they were going to keep working, the hospital arranged for a driver to pick them up at a designated location and escort them into the building. One day, the strikers beat up the hospital driver after he had dropped the women off, and for the first time, Ida May realized the seriousness of this thing. Then the hospital came up with another way to get Ida May and Doris to work. It arranged for a police wagon to pick up the two women at a designated bus stop. It was just like we were going to jail, Ida May said. They would climb out of the police wagon at the entrance to the hospital, and the police would walk them past the pickets into the building. Scabs! Some of the picketers, shivering on the cold sidewalk, would yell at Ida May and Doris. You a scab! Ida May would shoot back, not knowing the labor union meaning of the word, but hurling it anyway, because to her, everybody should have been working. Ida May couldn't let a heckler go unanswered, and it frightened Doris. Shut up, Ida! Doris whispered. Ida, hush. The two of them were working on the 6th floor in surgery, and on their breaks could look out the window and see the pickets below. After so many hours outside, the strikers had to find ways to protect themselves from the freezing wind. They would scurry to their cars and sit for a while, and they would use buckets instead of the toilet in the building, because the hospital wouldn't let them in. The strikers never threw anything but names at Ida May and Doris, and when the two of them looked back on it years later, they marveled that they had never gotten hurt. I wouldn't do that now, Doris said. Ida May turned to Doris. Well, I didn't really understand, Ida May said. We all supposed to be working. Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and Memphis, April 1968. The evening was unusually cool for Memphis in April. It was shortly before 6 o'clock, and Martin Luther King Jr. was heading to dinner before attending a rally for striking sanitation workers. He was standing on the 2nd-floor balcony of the Lorraine Motel on Mulberry Street, just outside his room, room 306. A half dozen of his aides were with him, gathering themselves to leave. Someone reminded King of how chilly it was getting. He agreed and went to get his top coat. At the precise moment that he turned back to his room, a minute past 6 on April 4th, 1968, a single 30-caliber bullet was fired into the balcony. The rifle shot, thought to have come from a flophouse across the street through the bare branches of the mimosa trees, struck him in the neck and severed his spinal cord. King was pronounced dead at St. Joseph's Hospital at 7.05 p.m., Central Time. Within hours, the poor, colored sections of more than 100 cities went up in flames. That night, George Starling was rounding the corner at 131st Street and St. Nicholas Avenue in Harlem. He was returning home from a night out with the guys and saw the fires rising up ahead. He was trying to get to 132nd and Lenox, not yet knowing what had happened to set the people off. The whole thing was a blur, and he was looking for a way to get around the mayhem. It was in the direction of St. Nicholas Avenue, he said. It could have been on Broadway, St. Nicholas, or Amsterdam. It was up on that hill. They were burning everything up there. The sky was lit up like it was the end of time. He made his way home, and it was only when I got into the house and turned on the radio that I heard the news that Martin Luther King had been shot in Memphis. The evening of the assassination, Ida May would cup her face in disbelief at the news playing out in a scratchy, continuous, uncomprehensible loop on the AM radio dial and the family's black-and-white television set. She would pray for the soul of the man she so admired and had once almost seen during his Chicago campaign 2 years before, as he had tried to free the people who had fled to the north. On the other side of town, over on the west side, police sirens wailed and rocks crashed through the plate glass windows of grocers and liquor stores. Whole blocks went up in smoke in Chicago, and on the streets of Newark, Detroit, Boston, Kansas City, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere. The receiving stations of the Great Migration would burn all through the night after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And when it was over, some neighborhoods, the old places the migrants had packed into when the migration began, would look like Berlin after an airstrike during the Second World War. The dispossessed children of the Great Migration, but more notably, the lifelong black northerners broken by the big cities, let out a fury that made a mockery of the free harbor the North was reputed to be. A presidential commission examining the disturbances found that more black northerners had been involved in the rioting than the people of the Great Migration, as had mistakenly been assumed. About 74% of the rioters were brought up in the North, wrote the authors of what would become known as the Kerner Report. The typical rioter was a teenager or young adult, a lifelong resident of the city in which he rioted. What the frustrated northerners appeared to be seeking was fuller participation in the social order and the material benefits enjoyed by the majority of American citizens, the commission found. The discontent of the young people unsettled the migrant parents who had fled the violence of the South. They could do little to dissuade their children from whatever role they might play in the outburst. It was too late to try to get them jobs at now-closed factories, or the education they missed if they gave up on school, or maybe most of all, the grounding and strength they themselves had acquired after having endured so much. The parents had come from the old country, had been happy to have made it out alive, and made a few dollars an hour. What did they know of the frustration of the young people who had grown up in the mirage of equality, but a whole different reality, in a densely packed world of drugs and gangs and disorder, with promises that seemed to have turned to dust? Ida May saw the destruction on the news, and as usual tried not to worry about things she could not control. George Starling managed to negotiate his way through the burning streets of Harlem. They had long since left the South where Dr. King had been killed, and yet they were pulled into the aftermath. In the North, the migrants grieved for the man who had worked miracles in the land of their birth, and thus for them, from afar. It was Thursday, a work day, and across the country, Robert Foster, workaholic that he was, would have been in his office attending his usual overflow of patients at what would have been late afternoon on the West Coast. His office on Jefferson and his house in West Adams were comfortably situated far from Watts, where the fires had burned 3 years before. Ever conscious of appearances and propriety, he would be nearly as incensed at the violence as he was stunned at the assassination. To him, spite never settled anything. It only gave your detractors more ammunition, and as it had back when the colored people in Monroe had urinated in the colored section of the Paramount Theater, only ended up hurting the people themselves. To Robert, the whole world had just about gone mad. A few years before King's death, Robert had been beside himself when he learned that Bunny, a student at Spelman College in Atlanta, caught up in the zeitgeist of the moment, was talking about maybe picketing too, as only a bourgeois daughter of the upper class would. It would not be trying to register poor people to vote in the backwoods of Mississippi, that was out of the question, but by, say, protesting Rich's department store in downtown Atlanta with a white-gloved delegation of other colored college girls. On this, Rufus Clement and Robert agreed. Bunny simply could not be seen being arrested with a riffraff, all because Rich wouldn't let colored girls try on hats. Of course, Robert understood the indignity, had lived it after all, which is why he had raised her in Los Angeles and taken her to Beverly Hills for whatever she and Alice and the other girls might ever think they wanted. It wasn't that he was against the civil rights movement. He was all for standing up for one's rights. It was just that to his way of thinking, the way to change things was to be better than anybody at whatever you did, wear them down with your brilliance, and enjoy the heck out of doing it. So he had no patience for these sit-in displays, at least for his daughters anyway, much less actual violence. The day King died was a dark day all around. It was around midnight that George encountered the destruction in Harlem. It wasn't all the people out in the streets that got his attention. It wasn't unusual for a lot of people to be out on the streets of Harlem if it were the least bit warm. What caught his eye were the flames. That Thursday evening in April, George had been hanging out with the guys over on Prospect Avenue. He was talking baseball and downing Boilermakers, a shot of Smirnoff's with orange juice, and a chaser of beer. He was trying to escape the disappointments of an underutilized mind and a sand trap of a marriage he was too loyal and upright to leave. The men were so distracted by the vodka and the joshing over the Yankees and the Mets and the Dodgers, who had years before left Brooklyn for Los Angeles, and over the baseball season that was to begin the very next week, that they failed to register the assassination of one of the most influential figures in American history. It was only when George finally made it into his car and back into Harlem that he realized that something terrible had happened. "The sky lit up," he remembered, "when I turned into 131st Street. As soon as I looked, I saw. The whole sky is on fire." George Starling knew what it meant to stare an enemy down in a life-and-death sort of way, and had respect for Dr. King. But by the time King was assassinated, George was unable to marshal much emotion. He had grown up with that kind of violence against people fighting the system and half expected it. No, what had really shaken him was the assassination 5 years earlier of John F. Kennedy, the president so many blacks had placed their hopes in, Kennedy having come from the North and from what they saw as a more enlightened generation than previous presidents. George was in Florida in November 1963. "I used to go down every October or November. I had just passed through Ocala on the way to Gainesville, and it was in the afternoon," George remembered. "And I turned the radio on and I heard them say, 'And the President of the United States has been assassinated. He was shot and he did not survive,' or something like that. And I said, 'Now what kind of joke is that?' And then it came back on. You know they wouldn't have risked repeating it over and over. And when I realized that Kennedy had really been killed, assassinated, that thing hit me. When I knew anything, I'd run off the road. I don't know what I was doing. And it just so happened that the shoulder was grassy. It wasn't that much traffic. It was in the mid-afternoon, and I just brought the car to a stop, and I just sat there, and I cried like a baby." For some reason, it was different with King than with Kennedy. Perhaps the losses were piling up, and George couldn't muster the same shock and pain anymore. "I didn't cry," he said. "I was just astonished. I was just numb. I couldn't believe it. Then I thought about his speech. He predicted his own death whether he knew it or not. He told it. 'I've been to the top of the mountain and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not make it there with you, but you will get to the promised land.'" James Earl Ray, a 40-year-old drifter and prison escapee, would be convicted of the murder. Ray left a trail of evidence that he had been stalking King for months, but until his own death in 1998 left questions as to what role he had actually played in the assassination. Ray was not from the South, as the migrants who left it might have expected. He was from Alton, Illinois. Precisely a week after King's death, and 2 years after King's brokered and dispiriting effort to end housing segregation in Chicago, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Fair Housing Act of 1968, banning discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, or national origin in the renting or selling of property. King's bruising fight for the people in the North would not be won until King had died. The fullness of the migration. And so the root becomes a trunk, and then a tree, and seeds of trees, and springtime sap, and summer shade, and autumn leaves, and shape of poems and dreams, and more than tree. Langston Hughes. The North and West, 1970. This was the year that demographers called the turning point in the exodus of black Americans out of the South. It was the year that the revolutions of the 1960s began to bear fruit, and black children were entering white schools in the South without death threats or the need for the National Guard. The people from the South continued to go north in great waves because nobody told them the migration was over, but fewer were leaving than in previous decades, and nearly as many blacks in the North and West, particularly the children of the original people of the Great Migration, began to contemplate or act upon a desire to return South, now that things appeared to be changing. Ida May, the sharecropper's wife from Chickasaw County, Mississippi, was not among them. She was like the majority of the original migrants, people who were not really migrants at all, but who had left for good and didn't look back. She was 57 years old now, a grandmother, and had been in Chicago for more than half her life. The elevated train, the 3 feet of snow falling in April when it had no business falling, the all-white neighborhood that had turned black in an eye blink, it was all part of her now. Her life revolved around family, church, and work, really no different than the order of things would have been in Mississippi, except that the city that brought freedom also brought unforeseen hazards and heartbreak. She had gotten used to the concrete and congestion, the press of buildings in place of the expansive field. She had learned to quicken her step as she walked to or from work, but she still smiled at people on the bus or reached out to help young mothers balancing babies and strollers. She was even getting to know the gangbangers who had begun to position themselves on the street corners to establish their turf and organize their drug inventory. She spoke to them, and they spoke back to her, calling her grandma and watching out for her to the dismay of her own children, whose objections she largely ignored because the gangbangers and their little lookouts were God's children too, to her way of thinking. She was in the city, but not fully wise to it, nor seeking to be. One day, coming home from work, she stepped off the curb at the green light for pedestrians to cross 87th Street at the Dan Ryan Expressway. The right turn on red had just been made legal. A man in a late-model sedan pulled out in front of the bus just as she was trying to cross. She fell onto the hood and then tumbled to the concrete. "That was a good fall," she said. She was sore, but not much else. The man who hit her was worried for her and drove her to Jackson Park Hospital, where she was declared fine, save for a few bruises to her arms, legs, and ego. They called her husband to tell him what had happened. "Oh, he fussed," she said, which looked to be the only way he knew to show he cared. "You should have watched where you were going," he told her when she got home. The idea of losing Ida May seemed to incite as much anger as worry in him. There was already a sense of lingering sadness in the house. Their beloved Velma, the little girl Ida May hadn't wanted at first, but whom she had held close and cherished, and who had ridden next to her, along with little James, on the train ride north, was gone now. There had been a car accident a few years before. The details of the crash somehow didn't matter so much in the eternity between getting the call and making it to the hospital. Ida May saw her firstborn trying to hold on to life, and then slip away. Ida May almost fell apart. Decades later, it would be the one thing she rarely talked about, as if not talking about it made it less real. And even though she knew full well that it was, she couldn't bear to let the thought of it slip into her subconscious. She acted as if it had never happened, and if it came up, her voice went uncharacteristically flat, and she quickly found something else to talk about. "The police," she would say. They was riding last night. Ida May and her husband had settled into whatever they were going to be in the North. They were blue-collar, church-going, tax-paying homeowners, with now two instead of three grown children. Ida May now had six little grandchildren, all of whom had been born within the bonds of holy matrimony, even though Eleanor's didn't manage to last, which perfectly reflected the demographics of the times. Ida May's husband was a deacon in the church, whose pastime was cheering the White Sox on television with their grandson Kevin and instructing him on the strategies of the game. Ida May and her husband were never going to go to college or rise much beyond where they were, but they had come a long way from where they had started, and that was an accomplishment in itself. Many years later, people would forget about the quiet successes of everyday people like Ida May. In the debates to come over welfare and pathology, America would overlook people like her in its fixation with the underclass, just as a teacher can get distracted by the two or three problem children at the expense of the quiet, obedient ones. Few experts trained their sights on the unseen masses of migrants like her, who worked from the moment they arrived, didn't end up on welfare, stayed married because that's what God-fearing people of their generation did, whether they were happy or not, and managed not to get strung out on drugs or whiskey or a cast of nameless, no-count men. There were two sets of similar people arriving in Chicago and other industrial cities of the North at around the same time in the early decades of the 20th century. Blacks pouring in from the South, and immigrants arriving from Eastern and Southern Europe in a slowing but continuous stream from across the Atlantic, a pilgrimage that had begun in the latter part of the 19th century. On the face of it, they were sociologically alike, mostly landless rural people put upon by the landed upper classes or harsh autocratic regimes seeking freedom and autonomy in the northern factory cities of the United States. But as they made their way into the economies of Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Milwaukee, and other receiving cities, their fortunes diverged. Both groups found themselves ridiculed for their folkways and accents, and suffered backward assumptions about their abilities and intelligence. But with the stroke of a pen, many Eastern and Southern Europeans and their children could wipe away their ethnicities and those limiting assumptions by adopting Anglo-Saxon surnames and melting into the world of the more privileged native-born whites. In this way, generations of immigrant children could take their places without the burdens of an outsider ethnicity in a less enlightened era. Doris von Koppelhoff could become Doris Day, and Isor Danielovich, the son of immigrants from Belarus, could become Kirk Douglas, meaning that his son could live life and pursue stardom as Michael Douglas, instead of as Michael Danielovich. A name change would have no effect in masking the ethnicity of black migrants like Ida May, George, and Robert. It would have been superfluous, given that their surnames, often inherited from the masters of their forebears, were already Anglo-Saxon. They did not have the option of choosing for themselves a more favored identity. They could not easily assimilate, whether they sought to or not. They could send their children to northern schools that were superior to anything back south, acquire a northern accent, save up for suits to replace the overalls and croker sack dresses of the field, but they would never be mistaken for an English or Welsh arriviste, the way a Czech or Hungarian immigrant could, if so inclined. Black migrants did not have the same shot at craft unions or foreman jobs, or country clubs, or exclusive cul-de-sac lace-curtain neighborhoods that other immigrants could enter if they were of a mind to do so. A daughter of white ethnics could instantly escape the perceived disadvantages of her origins by marrying a man of Northern or Western European descent and taking his surname. She and whatever children she bore could thus assume the identity of a more privileged caste. With the exception of extraordinarily light-skinned blacks passing over into the white world for these very same privileges, the daughter of the average black migrants would gain no such advantage by intermarrying. She would still be seen as black, and be subject to the scrutiny of the outside world, no matter whom she married or whose name she took. Even without trying to pass oneself off as anything other than what he or she was, an ethnic immigrant would not likely be distinguishable from any other white person boarding a train, lining up for a foreman's job, or waiting for a loan officer at a bank. Public situations that opened black migrants to immediate rejection, but that white ethnic immigrants were protected from by virtue of their skin color. Ultimately, according to the Harvard immigration scholar Stanley Lieberson, a major difference between the acceptance and thus life outcomes of black migrants from the South and their white immigrant counterparts was this. White immigrants and their descendants could escape the disadvantages of their station if they chose to, while that option did not hold for the vast majority of black migrants and their children. The ethnicity of the descendants of white immigrants was more a matter of choice because with some effort it could be changed, Lieberson wrote, and out in public might not easily be determined at all. The hierarchy in the North called for blacks to remain in their station, Lieberson wrote, while immigrants were rewarded for their ability to leave their old-world traits and become American as quickly as possible. Society urged them to leave Poland and Latvia behind and enter the mainstream white world. Not so with their black counterparts like Ida May, Robert, and George. Although many blacks sought initially to reach an assimilated position in the same way as did the new European immigrants, Lieberson noted, the former's efforts were apt to be interpreted as getting out of their place or were likely to be viewed with mockery. Ambitious black migrants found that they were not able to get ahead just by following the course taken by immigrants and had to find other routes to survival and hoped for success. Contrary to common assumptions about childbearing and welfare, many black migrants compensated for the disadvantages they faced by cutting back in every way they could, most notably by having fewer children than the Eastern and Southern Europeans arriving at the same time. Ida May, for example, bore no more children after the one she carried in her belly from Mississippi at the age of 25, despite the many fertile years she spent in the North. She and her husband could not afford another mouth to feed. It turned out that during the first 3 decades of the Great Migration, fertility rates for black women migrants from the South were actually among the lowest of all newer arrivals to the North, according to Lieberson's compilation of census data. In 1940, for the 15 to 34 age group, Ida May's at the time, there were 916 children per 1,000 black women, as against 951 for Austrians, 1,030 for Russians, 1,031 for Poles, 1,176 for Hungarians, and 1,388 for Italians. Czech women were virtually tied with black women at 923 children per 1,000 women. The disparities only widened with age. Among those in the 45 to 54 age group, Central and Eastern European immigrant women had borne, in some cases, twice as many children per 1,000 as black migrant women in the North in 1940, with the Russians having borne 3,111, the Hungarians 3,305, the Austrians 3,683, the Czechs 4,045, the Poles 4,192, and the Italians 4,638, compared to 2,219 children having been born to black women by the same point in their lives in the North. Clyde Vernon Kaiser, a political scientist at Columbia University studying the black migration from South Georgia to the Northeast in the 1930s, also found fertility to be significantly reduced by migration among black couples who went to both New York and Boston. The differences in most cases are of a massive nature, Lieberson reported. Blacks, though native-born, were arriving as the poorest people from the poorest section of the country with the least access to the worst education. Over the decades of the migration, they came with every disadvantage and found themselves competing not only with newcomers like themselves, but with second and third generation European immigrants already established in apprenticeships and factory jobs that were closed off to black migrants, the immigrants and their children permitted into the very trade unions that prohibited black citizens from joining. Because they were largely excluded from well-paying positions and even unskilled occupations, and were concentrated in servant work and other undesirable jobs, blacks were the lowest paid of all the recent arrivals. In 1950, blacks in the North and West made a median annual income of $1,628, compared to Italian immigrants who made $2,295, Czechs who made $2,339, Poles who made $2,419, and Russians who made $2,717. There is just no avoiding the fact that blacks were more severely discriminated against in the labor market and elsewhere, Lieberson wrote. They had to work more hours to earn less money than anyone else, the historian Gilbert Ossofsky wrote. The people of the Great Migration had farther to climb because they started off at the lowest rung wherever they went. They incited greater fear and resentment, in part because there was no ocean between them and the North, as there was with many other immigrant groups. There was no way to stem the flow of blacks from the South, as the authorities could and did by blocking immigration from China and Japan, for instance. Thus, blacks confronted hostilities more severe than most any other group, except perhaps Mexicans, who could also cross over by land, as it could not be known how many thousands more might come and pose a further threat to the pre-existing world of the North. The presence of so many black migrants elevated the status of other immigrants in the North and West. Black Southerners stepped into a hierarchy that assigned them a station beneath everyone else, no matter that their families had been in the country for centuries. Their arrival unwittingly diverted anti-immigrant antagonisms their way, as they were an even less favored outsider group than the immigrants they encountered in the North, and helped make formerly ridiculed groups more acceptable by comparison. Ida May was so isolated, living as she was in the all-black neighborhood of South Shore, that she had little contact with other immigrant groups, except perhaps at work. She tried to make the best of it, since she had no control over who had gotten to Chicago before she did, or how they lived or what they thought of her. Her world was small, purposely so, built around her family and the people she knew from back home in Mississippi, and that was the way she and her husband preferred it. New York, 1970, George Swanson Starling. This is what George Starling's life had become at its midpoint. He had made it up north all right, as he had dreamed so long ago. But he had an unhappy wife who could not be made happy, and two teenage children who were good at heart, but had been swallowed up by the worst aspects of the North and South, while he and his wife were out working long hours to give the kids a life they themselves had never had. He had a 2-year-old by another woman that he had to support, and a decent-paying but dead-end job as essentially a servant to railroad passengers needing help with their luggage, directions to their seats, another pillow, their shoes shined. He turned 52 in 1970. He had been in the North for a quarter of a century. He would never be the chemist or accountant he had seen for himself in his mind, would never work a white-collar job, or any kind of job that would make use of his intellect. And by an accident of birth, he had managed to suffer the terror and injustice of Jim Crow, but just missed the revolution that opened up the best in education and unheard-of career opportunities for black people with the passage of the civil rights laws of the 1960s. The revolution had come too late for him. He was in his mid-40s when the Civil Rights Act was signed, and close to 50 when its effects were truly felt. He did not begrudge the younger generation their opportunities. He only wished that more of them, his own children in particular, recognized their good fortune the price that had been paid for it, and made the most of it. He was proud to have lived to see the change take place. He wasn't judging anyone, and accepted the fact that history had come too late for him to make much use of all the things that were now opening up. But he couldn't understand why some of the young people couldn't see it. Maybe you had to live through the worst of times to recognize the best of times when they came to you. Maybe that was just the way it was with people. He did not dwell on this long or let it get him down. He stood as straight-backed now as he had when the South told him he didn't have a right to. He started going to church and found solace in that. He started singing in the choir. He had a way of sitting back and shaking his head at absurdities, whether segregationists training their terriers to mock black people in the South, or black people with no hope or home training shooting each other over a nickel bag in the North. The young people were letting their hair grow out and wearing afros that his generation would never have been seen out in public with. They were living together, shacking up, they called it, in a flouting kind of way that even now, tortured as his marriage was, he couldn't bring himself to do. They were taking things farther than he ever would have had the nerve to contemplate, preaching black power, calling the white man a devil, walking arm in arm down the street with white women, all of those things that would have gotten him killed when he was their age. The young people picked up on something strong and unnameable in him. They never bothered him as he climbed the stairs out of his basement apartment with his creaky and now arthritic knees, heading to work at Pennsylvania Station, or returning late at night from a 48-hour run. He knew more than most people of his generation precisely what he had missed out on, and what his life could have been. He had had a taste of college, knew he could do the work, and was convinced he could have succeeded. How complicated had the ending of his college career been? Looking back on it, the course of his life had turned on that moment. He would not have been working in the citrus groves, or had the standoff with the grove owners that had forced him to flee to the North if he had stayed in school. That moment would gnaw at him for as long as he lived. What if his father hadn't gotten it into his head that George had had enough schooling? If his father had helped out with the tuition George needed, if his father hadn't had a new family to support and chosen that obligation over college for his son. Then there was segregation. What if colored students had been allowed to attend the state schools near Eustis in George's day, as they could after the Civil Rights Movement, where it would have been easier for George to make a go of it, work and go part-time if he had to? Then there was George himself. At midlife, George had to search his soul and live with the regrets of his own missteps. If only he hadn't rushed to get back at his father by marrying a woman from the other side of the tracks, giving his father further reason to withhold his support, and leaving George with a wife to take care of besides, perhaps he would have gotten the education that would have allowed him to fulfill his potential. As it was, he had only to look at Inez to be reminded of what could have been. It was spite, George would say of the decisions he made at that moment in his life. He took every chance he got to warn young people not to make his mistakes, not knowing if they heard him, but feeling he had to get it out. "That's why I preach today, do not do spite," he said. "Spite does not pay. It goes around and misses the object that you aim and comes back and zaps you. And you're the one who pays for it." Los Angeles, 1970. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. On Christmas Day, 1970, Robert P. Foster turned 52 years old. He had been in Los Angeles for 17 years, but for some reason, he was unable to fill up on what he had acquired any more than he could carry fog in his satchel. He had a practice that minted money. With all those migrants from Texas and Louisiana, he had patients spilling out of his office and into the hall, sitting like refugees on the floor all day, waiting for him to check their blood pressure. By then, he found it hard to walk down a hospital ward without orderlies and scrub nurses hailing him from closing elevator doors. "Hey, Doc, remember me?" from some long-ago operation, and his feigning recollection so as not to disappoint them. He was comfortably situated. There was the well-born wife, the three beautiful daughters, and the 3,600-square-foot house west of Crenshaw, if only by a block, with the white Cadillac in the driveway. He was famous, even. Ray Charles's song about him, Hide Nor Hair, spent 7 weeks on the Billboard charts back in 1962. But he woke up that morning with the feeling that nothing mattered but the events that were about to unfold that day. Until this moment, he had lived his life with the perpetual sense of watching a reception through a keyhole, of arriving too late and without the proper documentation. There he would be at the front gate, all dressed and superior to the people inside, but afraid of being denied admittance. He craved acceptance from those most determined to withhold it from him, and met slights and rejections at nearly every turn. The small-minded people in that Jim Crow town, Rufus and Pearl Clement scrutinizing his every move since the day he married Alice, the colonel from Mississippi who wouldn't let him operate on white women, the motel clerks in Phoenix who denied him a room, the colored people who happened to have gotten to L.A. first and wouldn't lend a newcomer a hand, that hotel in Vegas. After all this time, he still couldn't shake these things. Rufus Clement had been dead for years. The run-in with the motel clerks in Phoenix, that was 17 years ago. The colonel, farther back than that. All the good and extraordinary things that had happened to him seemed never to make up for the rejection he had endured, and he set out to prove that he was better than what they took him for, even though the people who haunted him would never see it, no matter what he did. Because of the 51 previous years of his life, he had a number of complexes. He had a Napoleon complex, a Southern complex, a baby of the family complex. He had both a superiority complex and an inferiority complex, and because he was born on Christmas Day, a Christmas baby complex. He had never had much of a birthday party, a fate known to just about anyone who enters the world on Christmas. His mother had tried to give him a birthday party once when he was a young boy in Monroe. She invited all the children in Newtown. Only 4 came. That would not happen this time. He finally had all the pieces in place to celebrate his having arrived. In a few hours, he would give a gala in honor of himself. It would make up for all the parties he'd never had, all the slights he had ever suffered. It would prove to everyone that he had put Monroe in the South behind him and made it in L.A. He had worked it all out in his head. He would have guests from back east and up the coast and from all over the country. Monroe, too, of course. The best hams and the finest heavy bond paper for the invitations. Anything that anyone had ever thought of for a party, he would have. It would cost in the thousands, like the major motion picture wrap parties over in Beverly Hills, and he wanted the guests to see every dime of it. He had rehearsed the whole thing in his mind. That morning he woke up early, just like when he was a teenager back in Monroe, racing to lose himself in the celluloid illusion of California sophisticates from the colored balcony of the Paramount. Now he was in California, finally a sophisticate himself, and the urine-scented steps of the Paramount were from another lifetime. But as he rewound a tape that had yet to be recorded, a thunderstorm gathered in his stomach. He could hear the sounds of a party forming on the first floor. Footsteps on linoleum. The help skittering between the refrigerator and the sink and around the avocado green formica island back to the refrigerator again. The low screech of high chairs being positioned at the bar. The setting down of serving pieces and highball glasses. The opening and closing of the heavy front door with the arrival of roses and ice. He had done all he could, and now it was up to the workers, who, sweet though they might be, could not possibly understand how crucial it was that there be only cashews and almonds, and for God's sake, no peanuts in the nut bowls. The sound of urgent disorder rose up the staircase and into his room. Rather than being pleased that all was going more or less according to plan, he was sickened at the prospect that, for all his preparation, things might be less than perfect. He could hear the assembling of a party. The storm grew worse in his stomach.